in the Olympic Files. This is September 2018. This is part one of a program entitled National Security and Individual Freedom. Before getting into it, I was talking about left and right last time around and how fanatic, it seems to me, most Republican and Democrat supporters are, mainly blinded by an absolute radiant hatred for the other party. And I think they both suck. I mean, to me, these are two different paths leading to the same end. No, they're not the same. That's true. Each party has its supposed platform, doctrine, dogma. But I've always looked at the left as being kind of Bolshevik and the right being kind of Nazi. Democrats are criticized for wanting to give everything away. Republicans are criticized for wanting to take everything away. But they both lead to the same end, and here's where I'm going with this. When you're that devout an acolyte of your particular political party, what you really are doing is upholding and worshiping the primacy of the state. And I only realized that a couple of years ago when I met again a man that I had worked with in D.C. in 76, had maintained a friendship with him after the fact, when we both left D.C. And in the time I hadn't really spoken to him, the time that he had raised two children, I didn't realize how trenchant a Democrat he had become. And he was and still is an extremely intelligent, gifted person. And since we both worked in D.C. and we knew the way things really were, at least the way things get done in Washington, that he would actually become so much of a staunch supporter of any political ideology, because it's all horse maneuver in the end. Now, because, I mean, he worshipped Obama, and I had told him that I didn't particularly like or dislike Obama any more than any other president, but that I thought it was dangerous that during Obama's administration, his tenure, that he would preside over, as far as I can see, the first time ever, or without a doubt, the first time in my lifetime, where the government mandated that the public buy a product from the private market. And, of course, I'm talking about the Unaffordable Death Act. You know, I couldn't believe that that's what happened. I don't blame it on Obama any more than I would blame it on any other president for anything that happened under his or her watch. But to go out and tell people they have to do something and to send them to the private market seems to be, to me, what we would consider un-American. And really what it contained was the worst parts of capitalism and socialism. I mean, if you're going to mandate something, then to provide the product or the service, make it completely socialistic and let's just get over with it. Because it's a mess now. I mean, if more children are being covered and covered well, terrific. But for families, more times than not, if they weren't getting coverage from their employer, they were taking it out of their own pockets. And I mean, to avoid the fine, which is another thing, if you don't do this, they don't really care. I mean, the government doesn't care if you're covered or not. If you're not covered, they just want the money. They want another revenue stream. I mean, why not take that fine and turn it into your premium payment and put people as they do with auto insurance, in an unassigned risk category and let the money go for something. But no, the government just took the money. So you have families that have deductibles of $6,000 up to $8,000 because they're rolling the dice that they're not going to need the coverage. Because then if that's the case, then all you're really getting from insurance is catastrophic coverage in a sense. So if you have a $6,000 deductible, you don't have insurance. You don't. So that was a complete mess. But what I don't like is that it set a precedent as far as I can figure out. I mean, I know the Banking Act from 32 was a stinker, but still, you had to go out and buy something from the private market. So I had said that, and he defended it, and because he's got tremendous coverage. And I told him, well, I don't, and I'm paying a fine, and I can't figure out why I can't at least have that money directed toward coverage. You know, the government's going to be so kind to me, so good to me, then you could at least take the money that you're punitively assessing against me and put it toward the coverage that you want me to have so badly. And how in the United States can you have a medical industry such a mess? I mean, how do you screw that up and make it worse than it was when I was getting coverage and covering it myself as a young adult in the early 70s? So he got a little irritated with me. I'm saying, I'm sorry. I mean, I understand that the system as it was wasn't good, but this is worse. And plus it drove doctors away. And as I had said the last time, if you have a doctor, if it's a good doctor, that's a gem. It really is. Suddenly doctors have decided, I don't want to do this anymore, and have left the field. But getting back to the left and right thing, if you're that much of a diehard supporter of your party, then you will be that much more of a fanatic supporter of the state if your administration gets in, if your party gets in the administration, let's put it that way. And that's the danger, because believing in the primacy, the omnipotence of the state is frankly totalitarianism. Now, we're headed towards socialism if it seems to me that most young people coming out of the public school system and from the colleges believe in socialism because they believe in the platitude of being treated equally. And I would say to them, yes, equally as dogs. Capitalism, to a certain extent, is being excoriated for all its faults, and it's got more losers than winners, that's for sure. So they denigrate capitalism and then give you socialism as the antidote. But all socialism is a slippery slope toward communism, communitarianism. What it all comes down to in the very end is that it's the totality of the state. It's totalitarianism, and that's going to be world rule once upon a day to come. Now, along those lines, too, what we're seeing now is an era of terror. And terror is the last tool in the government toolbox to bring their people into subjugation to the state. So this is the last card being played. There is organic terror. There's no two ways about it. But the real serious stuff is certainly contrived by government. And in the United States, that would include, just to take the highlights, the high lowlights, it would be the sinking of the Maine and of the Lusitania. We'll get into that later on. Pearl Harbor, 9/11. So the government has no compunction about sacrificing its citizenry to obtain a goal. So it doesn't matter who's in office. It doesn't make a difference, because what is to happen will happen. And whoever's in office has been charged with carrying out that part of the plan. The road to world government. Awesome. Now, if, and I said this years ago when I found out back in probably around 2002, 2003, working in a library, college library, and I had an old 1972 Merriam-Webster dictionary. I had gotten it when I was going to college, and I kept it. I mean, I just pitched it in the landfill probably, yeah, 8 years ago. But I had looked up the definition of terror in that dictionary. And then in the library, I looked in some of the new dictionaries post 2000, 2001, and realized that the definition of terror had changed. Prior to the change, terror was directed as a means of government to control its people. So it was government terror against the people. Now it's people's terror against the government. And you can look that up. So terror is extremely effective, and you don't always have to have the events. You just have to have the threat of them. You have to have an event. You have to have something real for there to be a chronicling of the event that can be reshown, like 9/11 time and time again, reminding people to be afraid. But you really don't have to have that many more. You just have to say, well, there was a threat. Oh, they stopped the threat. Did they really? Oh, yeah. They knocked this out. They knocked that cell out. Oh, we almost had something. And you'll get the same results as if you had the event, except that with the event, you actually have a body count. And if you wish, you can read a kind of a history of terror and totalitarianism in Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, or in Trotsky's Terrorism and Communism, also previously titled A Defense of Terror. And I found it interesting, I mean, because no matter where you are, whether you're in Russia or you're in the United States, whether you're in Thailand, everybody's headed to the same cathedral of the state, of totalitarianism. Doesn't matter what your political system is or supposed to be, you're headed to the same place. And I found it interesting, just reading a short paragraph from Trotsky's Defense of Terror, otherwise known as Terrorism and Communism, a Reply to Trotsky. Yeah, Trotsky, you know, he never met a word he didn't like. I mean, he levels this reply to Trotsky, and he writes a whole book to do so. And also, that there's a couple of versions of that book. I realize they're not all the same. I would probably read Defense of Terrorism. You can find that on archive.org. Praise God for that resource, for as long as it lasts. And I had a laugh once, too. There's a book called Towards Soviet America by William Z. Foster. It was written in the early 30s, prior to the administration of Frankie the Red Roosevelt. I don't blame FDR either. He's another tool. Foster was actually laying down what would happen. Got to get to that sometime. Under Roosevelt's administration. So he knew the plan. Foster was at that time, I believe, second in command of the American Communist Party. Earl Browder was number one. Browder would get kicked to the curb later on, and Foster would be the main guy. But I found it interesting that Foster was saying, this is what's going to happen, and this is what's going to happen. And almost laughingly, he said, you know, if you were told that it was communism, it would be bad. But if you're saying, but in America, they call it federalization, and that's okay. And probably 1932 under FDR, was the greatest Sovietization, socialization of the United States, with government bureaus popping out all over. So this is from Defense. Oh, yeah, I want to tell you, that's right. Why didn't you remind me? I first got the book through interlibrary loan, and it came from, I believe it was, Samford College in Florida. They had a law school there. And so I get the book, and there's like 20 pages ripped out. And penciled in the book was an explanation by the political organization of college students, who believe, I guess, themselves the more pristine socialists or communists. They ripped out 20 pages they didn't like out of Foster's book. And what cracks me up is, you know, all these political parties are supposed to be the best for human beings, et cetera, et cetera, and they all do the same fascist things. So this particular party of the people rips out 20 pages of Foster's book, which they don't like. I mean, that happens all the time in the United States. But so you see, there's no political party that's benign. It really is just another mob. So, yes, in this particular book, Defense of Terror or Terrorism and Communism, there are alterations. You can read, I guess, the most modern version on Marxist.org, and you can go to archive.org for the oldest ones. But this comes from the oldest one, A Defense of Terror. It says, voluntary mobilizations for labor problems in the party and in the Young Community League are carried out with just as much enthusiasm as hitherto for military tasks. Voluntarism supplements and gives life to universal labor service. The committees for universal labor service, recently set up, have spread all over the country. The attraction of the population to work on a mass scale, and in parentheses, clearing snow from the roads, repairing railway lines, cutting timber, chopping and bringing up wood to the towns, simple building operations, the cutting of slate and of peat, end of parentheses, become more and more widespread and organized every day. The ever-increasing employment of military formations on the labor front would be quite impossible in the absence of elevated enthusiasm for labor. And what bothers me in this is that compulsory, and later on it talks about compulsory volunteerism. It's an oxymoron. If it's compulsory, it's not volunteerism. So what you're doing is just getting prison labor. And remember that catchphrase, universal labor service. Well, fast forward to 2003, and even up to, I think, 2013, there was a piece of legislation on the Hill that's never been passed into law. I think it struck out about five or six times, but what bothers me is that it doesn't go away. It still stays there, and it was brought up by Charlie Rangel and the Democrats. And it was originally entitled Universal Military Service Act, and they changed the word. They changed the title. They took military out and put in national. Sounds better. So now it's known as the Universal National Service Act. And here's a summary of the bill. And remember, universal labor service, right? All right. To require all persons in the United States between the ages of 18 and 25 to perform national service either as a member of the uniformed services or as civilian service in a federal, state, or local government program or with a community-based agency or a community-based entity, to authorize the induction of persons in the the induction of persons in the uniformed services during wartime to meet end strength requirements of the uniformed services, which means it's a draft, okay? To provide for the registration of women under the Military Selective Service Act and for other purposes. So here we had the Universal Labor Service written about by Trotsky, and here we have the Universal National Service Act. And I mean, it was far more draconian in previous drafts. One of them had the ages of 18 to, I think, 49. But it doesn't go away, all right? And just remember that, because it's going to rear its head again, and it's going to become law. And we take another step toward the Sovietization of the United States. And the title of this program, again, is National Security and Individual Freedom. And it's based on a lecture given by John Lord O'Brien at Harvard in April 1955. Now, John Lord O'Brien, you can read about. And it was April 27th and April 28th, to be exact. You can read about O'Brien, because when I first came upon this, this was a book that was deselected from one of the donations we got at the university from a deceased professor. And there were a lot of nuggets in there, but not all of them made the cut. So this book was deselected, and I grabbed it, and that's how I came upon it. But at that time, around, I guess it was 2002, there wasn't much on the internet about John Lord O'Brien, and you would spell O'Brien O apostrophe B-R-I-A-N if you want to look for him. And I thought it interesting because he was a leading Republican at one time in the state of New York. So it didn't make a difference what party he belonged to. He felt very strongly about what was happening in the United States post-World War II. And when I first covered this years ago in one of the forms my program took, is I'm more or less progressed through a search to find the way things really were in the world and in the United States. And at that time, there wasn't a whole lot about O'Brien. There's a lot more now, and I'm surprised because, well, that's how quickly information proliferates on the Internet, and it's one of the better things about the Internet. So O'Brien gave his lecture across 2 days in Harvard. The first part was called Security in an Age of Anxiety. The second part was titled Security, Sanity, and Fair Play. The things that people are concerned about now who understand how freedom can be eroded with supposedly the best of intentions. I mean, after all you have to do is scare people, put fear in them about terrorism, and they'll say, do whatever you have to do. That's the line. Or at least that's the only line you ever hear out of anyone's mouth who's interviewed for that, 3-second soundbite on the nightly news. Well, do what you have to. Okay, kid. The true case of be careful what you wish for. So when you hear this, I mean, coming in 1955, and I said it as I did it the first time, I didn't mention the year or anything. I just went into it. And, of course, people thought it was addressing what was going on post-2001. And it is, in a sense, but it started back post-1945, when things got quite a bit stranger in the United States, even though we were basking in the glow of kicking Adolf's and Tojo's butt. We didn't realize what was being done as servicemen and families were trying to get themselves back together again after being apart and going through all that stress. The soldiers came back to work. The economy was doing well. The Levittowns were being built. And really, that is exactly when a major move by the robber barons with their foundations were changing the shape of governance in the United States. Now let's get right to the speech. The umbrella title is National Security and Individual Freedom. The first part that was given on the first of 2 days, that subtitle is Security in an Age of Anxiety. By way of prologue, I should like to express my intention to discuss here certain far-reaching changes in law, in constitutional theory, and the attitude of the public toward our institutions, which have been developing during the present generation and which, if not halted, may result in a permanent reorientation of the individual citizen in his historic relationship to government and organized society. In attempting an analysis of these separate recent tendencies, we should first remind ourselves of their background and the vast changes during our time which have taken place outside our borders in our balancing of the relationship between the status of the individual and government, and in our own thinking as related to the constitutional liberties of the citizen. Such a survey should enable us to study in better perspective the immediate dangers that threaten our nation, and then to weigh those forces against the elements of stability which for many generations have characterized the American polity. It was a favorite saying of Elihu Root that in observing certain phenomena, political or social, we should take the long look and concern ourselves not with incidents, but with tendencies. Mr. Justice Holmes expressed much the same view in saying that the best service that we can do our country and ourselves is, quote, to see as far as one may and to feel the great forces that are behind every detail, for that makes all the difference between philosophy and gossip, between great action and small, end of quote. And that was part of a speech that Root gave at Harvard in 1911. Now back to O'Brien's words. It is in this spirit that I should like to review in these pages the overshadowing problems affecting human liberty in our time. But first, I should like to speak briefly of some of the causes that have brought us into the age of anxiety in which we live. It was not so many years ago that Professor Whitehead, with his urbane optimism and out of the wealth of his profound learning, assured us, quote, that there is a freedom lying beyond circumstance derived from the direct intuition that life can be grounded upon its absorption in what is changeless amid change, end of quote. But since those words were spoken, the new and startling discoveries of science have raised a cloud of doubts which, we are told, will inevitably affect some of our oldest convictions on the nature of physical life, on man's relationship to the universe, and more particularly on the problems of human destiny. As J. Robert Oppenheimer has told us, continuous change, accompanied by unaccountable variance, appear to be the only settled law of nature's processes. And the greatest of the changes that science has brought us is the, quote, acuity of change, end of quote. Dr. Oppenheimer has also warned us that our world is, quote, a new world in which the unity of knowledge, the nature of human communities, the order of society, the order of ideas, the very notions of society and culture have changed and will not return to what they have been in the past, end of quote. Although it is impossible to predict the ultimate result of these new conceptions, there is no doubt that for the time being, they have had a most disturbing effect, have created problems presently insoluble, and have obscured our sense of values. Our critical developments during the last generation have provided fresh emphasis for reconsideration of the status of the individual in today's society. Until recently, we could rejoice in the statement of Mr. Justice Brandeis that, quote, the right to be left alone by the government is the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized man, end of quote. And that was part of a decision that Brandeis gave in the Olmstead versus United States case in 1928. Now back to O'Brien. But as far back as 1940, Professor McIlwain had sounded the warning that, quote, never in recorded history has the individual been in greater danger from government than now, end of quote. And that was from McIlwain's book, Constitutionalism, Ancient and Modern, published in 1940. Even earlier, John Dewey and others had warned that the fundamental beliefs and practices of democracy were being challenged as they never had before. It is noteworthy that these considered statements were made before we entered upon the Second World War. To many serious-minded students today, this warning seems even more impressive and minatory. And I just want to add, as an aside, John Dewey is no good guy. Yeah, the father of modern education was also a full-blown statist who believed that the individual's worth was only his worth to the society, the collective, and nothing more. And I think you could see that from that mentality and philosophy, education in the United States especially turned to more conditioning rather than a true education. And, of course, he's joined along with Benjamin Bloom in his famous taxonomy and B.F. Skinner in injecting that thought of collectivism. You can call it communitarianism. Certainly the individual is secondary. And, you know, it goes along with our Pledge of Allegiance. How dare I say that, right? But that means a pledge to the state. I'm not so sure about that. Moving on. In the field of economics, we have witnessed the emergence of a highly industrialized and interdependent society with its component elements of conflicting forces. The pressures from these developments are operating, as they have for some decades, in the direction of diminishing the freedom of the individual and decreasing his importance, in contrast to what is thought to be the general welfare. Paradoxically, the enactment of social legislation, much of it long overdue, has tended to intensify the desire of the citizen to obtain an even greater degree of economic security. In fact, although objectives of the welfare state are certainly worthy objectives, we must admit that this great concept has to a substantial degree encouraged growth in the idea of the supremacy of the state over the status of the individual. The concentration of power and growth of centralized authority in different national industries and even in the larger labor unions everywhere tends to induce conformity and acquiescence. And just to inject it again, in 1932, okay, because of the Depression and because of the Wall Street crash and all that, there was a greater and greater, call it what you want, federalization, Sovietization, socialization, where the state began to become bigger and bigger. And this is a really an interesting time in history. Because while all of that was going on, there was also that ridiculous fake coup where supposedly, and this has been very much misunderstood, Smedley Butler was going to lead battalion of soldiers or whatever, down to D.C. to overthrow FDR. And supposedly this was backed by Wall Street. Won't get into it now, but there was another distraction. It was baloney. Nobody even got a day's worth of jail out of this. It was strictly a distraction. The reason I bring it up is because then after that we get ourselves in World War II, and people aren't really paying all that much attention to what took place in answer to the Banking Act. And how draconian those measures were in the Banking Act itself. So after you get through this original increase of the state, you're having all kinds of distraction, perhaps a coup in the country, and then we get into World War II, and by the time this is all over, there's a whole different mindset going on. And really what this is addressing, what O'Brien is addressing in this time, is now World War II is past, there's a quietude to some sorts, there's this prosperity for GIs and for everyone. Forget the fact that we went back to war again in Korea, and nobody knew what that was about who could understand that. So we've come out on the other side of this now. But again, during that time prior to World War II, there was this increase of the power of the state over the individual. Now, social programs, yes, some of them were needed. A lot of them weren't supposed to last forever, but once they were in, you can't get them out, more or less. Moving on. The same pressures have long been apparent in the field of education, where interference by politicians, pressure groups, and intolerant busybodies is tragically frequent, and in some cases is injuriously effective. That the weight of mass opinion constantly tends to smother the individual's sense of initiative and independence is an elemental truth long since verified by experience. The process of mass education and the use of mass media of communication, such as the continuous drum fire of the radio announcers, are tending to make mediocrity the accepted standard and to reduce the intrinsic importance of the individual citizen. The current evolution in steadily expanding mechanization may have the same effect. And there's a footnote here, and quite interesting, too. It's a two-paragraph footnote. It begins, "What menaces democratic society in this age is not a simple collapse of order nor yet usurpation by a single powerful individual, but a tyranny of mediocrity, a standardization of mind and spirit and condition enforced by the central government." And that's from Russell Kirk, The Conservative Mind, published in 1953. The second paragraph. In his recent book, Walter Lippmann expresses grave anxiety over the mounting power acquired by mass opinion in the 20th century, which, he asserts, has already shown itself to be a dangerous master of indecision when the stakes are life and death. He also emphasizes, as a surprising development, that the enfranchised masses have not been the ones who have most staunchly defended the institutions of freedom. And that's from his The Public Philosophy, published in 1955. And all this is leading to what we were saying about the world to come. It is not going to be about individual freedom at all. It's about knowing your place and being treated only in the manner in which your value shows itself to the whole. And again, as I had said before, this whole bit about democracy is nothing more than putting lipstick on mob rule. That's all it is. And what they're talking about mass communication, of course, in that time we're only dealing with print, really, papers and radio. TV was already established, but not part of, you know, the social fabric of the country across the board, because obviously those who had better economic means had TVs, others had to wait. So it wasn't the tool of mass communication as it is now and beyond. But the point is that if you get people plugged into that and you keep working on them, most people aren't going to be independent of thought or have the common sense or have the temerity to buck the system. They're going to go along with it, become a bunch of Eloi, which is what we have today. And, of course, now it's even worse because of everyone being plugged in all the time. I mean, it's not the good information that they're usually got their eyes on or their ears to. What they're getting is just nothing but propaganda and mass manipulation, and they're enjoying it. And they are, as the title of Neil Postman's book reminds us, they are, or we are, amusing ourselves to death. All right, back to the speech. Another consideration of the greatest importance in affecting our sensitiveness to the rights of the individual and his freedom is the corrosive effect of the last war and the reemergence of totalitarianism as an aggressive force during the last few decades. One of the most disturbing symptoms of our time is the casual way in which our people are already endeavoring to forget the events of that catastrophic period. Let us recall for a moment some of the happenings. In that period, millions and millions of innocent persons were deliberately murdered, and unspeakable practices of torture were revived on a wholesale scale. Every primary value treasured by Western civilization was and still is under attack. Numberless innocent persons suffered depths of agony beyond belief. Macabre methods of devilish ingenuity were devised to debase the minds and spirits of human beings, and even to destroy their personalities. Slave labor under the most abominable conditions was revived and practiced on a scale undreamed of heretofore. Perfidy has been erected into a principle of state policy. These atrocities, this descent into brutality and bestiality, required the participation of hundreds of thousands of men, civilians as well as soldiers, and their brutalizing effect upon them, as well as their influence upon others, is something that only the future can measure. Looking at the distortion of values in Europe, No man today can prophesy how this vast quantum of human suffering, despair, and resentment will affect, as it is bound to do, the thinking of civilized man in the coming generations. The memory of these bitter and terrifying spectacles we deliberately seek to put aside. Yet it is a platitude to say that no barriers can ever protect us from the imponderable and evil influences that must result from these tragedies. Already as a nation, we are suffering from the impact of a disorganized external world and from the widespread challenges of, quote, modern barbarism, end of quote. But the effect of poisonous ideologies upon our internal affairs is only one aspect of the danger. The other aspect is the effect upon our nation's prestige and capacity for moral leadership in the outside world. If we weaken in maintaining those principles of justice and fair play, which, in the past, have given American civilization its distinctive quality. I have mentioned the intellectual claims of the nuclear scientists, the shattering events of the war, the emergent totalitarianism, and the unprecedented power of the forces making for intolerance and conformity, because throughout a great part of the civilized world, these influences have all but obliterated any respect for the sanctity of the individual. The combination of these influences has produced, even in this country, a climate of opinion increasingly conducive to the depreciation of the rights of the individual by the exercise of governmental functions. The same forces also tend to inevitably weaken the individual's sense of responsibility for government. And here we approach a crucial threat to our society, for the oldest and most serious danger to the democratic state is the growth of complacency and indifference toward the processes of government and the difficulty of combating the danger. It is generally agreed that at least one of the chief causes of the decline and disintegration of ancient society was the gradual withdrawal from the citizen of any real responsibility as well as any adequate opportunity to participate in functions of local government. Any influence from whatever source that tends to decrease the citizen's sense of personal responsibility for the integrity of his government is a source of danger to the democratic state. In the light of the three centuries of political evolution, no historical fact is better settled than this. It is eternal struggle as well as eternal vigilance that is the price of liberty. For the problem of how to encourage and preserve the individual's sense of responsibility for his government is a new problem for every generation. Since our recognition of the welfare state, the problem has taken on new aspects. As described by the late Justice Jackson, the citizen is confronted with new temptations in appraising the essential values. And this is a quote from Jackson. It seems to me that these traditional freedoms are less in danger of any sudden overthrow than of being gradually bartered or traded for something else on which the people place a higher current value. In this anxiety-ridden time, many are ready to exchange some of their liberties for a real or fancied increase in security against external foes, internal betrayers, or criminals. Now listen to that. Does this sound familiar? One more time. In this anxiety-ridden time, many are ready to exchange some of their liberties for a real or fancied increase in security against external foes, internal betrayers, or criminals. Others are eager to bargain away local controls for a federal subsidy. Again, my parenthetical comment, and this is what has happened in the United States. Many will give up individual rights for the promise of collective advantages. The real question posed by the fascist and communist movements, which together have captivated a large part of the world's population, is whether today liberty is regarded by the masses of men as their most precious possession. Certainly in the minds of many foreign peoples, our type of individual liberty has been outvalued by promises of social welfare and economic security, which they want too passionately to be critical of the price. If this indifference to traditional values should spread to us, it would be the greatest threat to our own liberties. And that's the end of the quote, and certainly this has happened, and it by design. And I believe that these individuals knew it was happening, didn't want to believe that it would be allowed to, but I guess feared, and rightly so, that it would. Now, that quote was from Robert H. Jackson. It appeared in an article in the American Bar Association Journal, November 1953, the article's title, The Task of Maintaining Our Liberties, The Role of the Judiciary. back to O'Brien's speech. Does not this go to the very heart of our overall problems? And, of course, we know that it has. Recently, Chief Justice Warren expressed much the same anxiety in declaring that the times in which we are living are not normal times, and that the interplay of hope and fear, belief and doubt, determination and frustration are keeping the affairs of mankind and the minds of people in a state of turbulence, a turbulence that destroys perspective and clouds the vision. He also emphasizes that entirely apart from the totalitarian menace, the emotional influence of the times, coupled with the latent suspicion and prejudice inherent in human nature, may prove a threat to the basic rights of everyone, and of course it has. And that was from an address that Warren gave at, interestingly, Washington University, February 19th, 1955. And O'Brien again. In the attempt to make a pragmatic approach to the solution of the problems which confront us in the political field, we may assume, I think, that the public at large identify and recognize the more serious dangers. Let it be understood at the outset that we are agreed that the dangers to our nation, internal as well as external, are serious dangers. And let it also be agreed that the nation must protect itself against these dangers by some kind of security program. The immediate and more serious problem is how to appraise the extent of these dangers. This means an appraisal of the character and scope of communist activities in this country, a determination of what injurious results have been achieved by these activities, and what are the forces making for stability in the American nation. Admittedly, this is an area at present characterized by intense emotionalism and by a pervasive sense of insecurity of a kind hitherto unknown in this country, and which, unfortunately, has been widely exploited by politicians for partisan purposes. We may put aside discussion of military necessities, for in view of the policy promulgated by Soviet Russia, all of us realize keenly the necessity of building up American military power, no matter at what cost. But another and the immediate threat to our institutions derives from a different cause, the techniques of propaganda and indoctrination which have been consistently practiced by the Soviet government for at least the past 25 years. What's interesting to me is that before he mentions about the threat, if you will, to individual thought by mass communication, and yet here he says the techniques of propaganda and indoctrination which have been consistently practiced by the Soviet government for at least the past 25 years. Now, I can give O'Brien credit for an awful lot, and I can't really discredit him for not knowing, maybe even not suspecting, that techniques of propaganda have been used here for longer than 25 years. I mean, go back to what Edward Bernays laid out back in the early 20s. They already had an idea. Who's they? I mean, the real government, the robber barons at that time, who locked up as much influence as they could, bought as many politicians as possible to get them into a position where they could never really be challenged. So with mass communication available here, and that, as we said before, at that time was only print and radio. At the time of the speech in 1955, TV was in show it. Not in every home, but soon it would be, obviously, and far more powerful than print or radio. So he doesn't quite get the fact that what he's complaining about, he's right. And that's doing the damage with propaganda, just as he accuses the Soviet Union of using it on their folks for 25 years. It's the same stuff, man. It's just different names. All of us now know that from the date of our official recognition of Russia down through the years of the Second World War, the Russian government, although professedly an ally in the war, was unremittingly advancing its secret policies aimed at the destruction of our institutions. This infiltration was advanced by two groups. First, the professional espionage agents who successfully sought secret information of a military character, particularly with reference to the invention of the atomic bomb, and second, the followers organized into cells and carefully nurtured in the deadly amoral teachings which already have caused infinite damage to Western civilization. It is important to note that the activities of these groups fall into two separate periods of time, the first being roughly from 1933 to the end of the war, and the second from that date until the present time. If the Soviet propaganda is, as we believe, a source of serious danger, that danger was at its height in the first period, which ended with the war. Looking back, with the advantages of hindsight, we can see that there were many events which should long ago have aroused the resentment and caution of the Americans. We are now told, for example, that at the close of the war, Stalin secretly proposed that our allies line up and shoot 50,000 high-ranking German leaders. And shortly thereafter, it was suggested by others that the Allies collect and turn over to the Soviets 500,000 young Germans, regardless of personal guilt, for labor reparations. Perhaps it was the horrors perpetuated in the war by both Nazis and the Russians that blinded us to the true significance of the situation and caused our failure to detect the demoniacal features of the powers loosed for attack upon our institutions. This is all the more strange because for many years we had realized the import of Lord Acton's warning that, quote, passion for power over others would never cease to threaten mankind, end of quote. We had imposed constitutional restraints upon our government, and we had consistently denounced all forms of secret procedures. These failures of ours suggest the public truth of the statement that what is new in the world is, quote, the massive character of the dissolution and corruption of authority in belief, in ritual, and in temporal order, end of quote. It is only fair to say, however, that what now appears to have been ineptness on the part of our public officials as well as our citizenry was, of course, chiefly owing to the secret and novel methods by which Soviet propaganda had been exploited with the greatest skill. It was a type of warfare with which our people had never been confronted. When the exposures came, the American people were at first confused and engulfed by an overmastering and unreasoning sense of fear. For us as a nation, this psychological atmosphere of sudden emotional reaction and confused thinking has already proved to be the most costly, the most disastrous, and the most lasting effect of the Second World War. This is especially noteworthy because the whole American way of life, to say nothing of the confidence of the citizen in the government, is based, as we all know, upon a belief in the dignity of the individual accompanied by a pervasive sense of intelligent toleration and respect for the rights of others. The most dangerous of all aspects of communism, as we now know, is that its protagonists have succeeded in developing a technology which destroys in the individual all sense of personal honor, decency, and good faith. There are many illustrations of this, the most conspicuous being the treason of scientists like Fuchs, the Rosenbergs, Ponteverdo, and those engaged in the Canadian conspiracy. Although all of these trusted persons had taken oaths of loyalty and also of secrecy, they later frankly disavowed any sense of obligation or of personal honor. This is the terrifying aspect of communism which is incomprehensible to the citizen of the Western world. The emergence of these soulless individuals trained in treachery is clearly the result of some new psychological technique with which we still are unable to cope and for which, as yet, no antidote has been found other than our reassertion of faith in the older moralities. This development is both the most difficult and the most dangerous for the Western world, yet we cannot wholly acquit ourselves of blame for the progress of communist propaganda, so far as it has made any impression here or abroad. As Arnold Toynbee expresses this criticism, quote, communism has a technique or know-how of its own for showing up the seamy side of Western civilization and magnifying it. This is proof that the challenge the communist presents comes ultimately not from him, but from ourselves. That is the end of the quote, to which is attached the footnote, also a quote, and it's from Civilization on Trial. If I have read history aright, human institutions have rarely been killed while they are alive. They commit suicide or die from lack of vigor, and then the adversary comes and buries them. This was quoted in the notes on the Harvard Tercentenary in 1936. There's much to be said about this, but I'm not going to say it now.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Do you have any idea how crazy you are?
Again, this is from a speech entitled National Security and Individual Freedom. And I've been reading from the first part of this two-day speech given by John Lord O'Brien. And this part is entitled Security in an Age of Anxiety.
You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.